The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Morris Williams, and it's my privilege to welcome each of you to the Free Library of Philadelphia tonight for what's going to be a very special treat hearing Professor Karen King talk to us. But first, let me ask you to turn off your cell phones and remind you of no flash photography. Second, let me suggest that you buy her book, Reading Judas, and join her upstairs after the Q&A for a book signing. Unfortunately, Professor Elaine Pagels will not be with us tonight due to flu. She sends her regrets, but the flu bug has prevented her from traveling. The library will seek to reschedule her, and hopefully that will work out. But you are in for a wonderful insight to this fascinating book by Professor King. You have her bio in terms of the program notes, but I would just share with you a couple of things that aren't in the program notes that I learned a few minutes ago, which I found fascinating. The first is that after graduating from the University of Montana, Professor King, before she became a PhD, spent a year as a nanny for Calvin Trillin and his family in New York City. The second aspect of her educational journey that I found fascinating was that her PhD work was really done in Berlin, and her true thesis advisor was a leading professor in East Germany. And so she walked across the border through the wall, because the wall was there in the late 70s and early 80s. And so that's, I think, a fascinating journey in and of itself, because obviously there were restrictions in terms of what you could carry in and out of East Germany. And her scholarship was continued there and became led to her PhD, which then led to her journey of spending 15 years in California as a professor at Occidental, before returning to Harvard, where she's been for the past 9 years as a tenured professor in the Divinity School. So please join me in giving a wonderful welcome to, I think, an outstanding scholar, Professor Karen King.
Good evening. It's a tremendous pleasure to be here. I bring you greetings from my colleague and friend and co-author Elaine Pagels. She is indeed very distressed to be here. She's out with the flu, I think you were told. But she wanted me to give you her greetings and to let you know that she would much, 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 much prefer to be here with you in all kinds of ways. I want to talk to you tonight a little bit about the Gospel of Mary. No, I don't. I want to talk about the Gospel of Judas. Probably I really do want to talk about Mary, but and we're going to talk about Judas. One of the questions one might begin would be by asking, where did the Gospel of Judas come from? Well, it's one of several new discoveries from the Egyptian desert that have been made over the last century or so that are changing our understanding of ancient Christian history. These finds have been made at places in central Egypt mostly. The most famous of these is probably the Nag Hammadi find, which was made in 1945. It was a clay jar was found with a set of papyrus books called codices in it, containing over 45 different early Christian works, many of which we had not previously known. Before this, in 1896, another manuscript, another codex, another book written in Coptic language, which is the Egyptian language, was found also in the same area of Middle Egypt, containing works like the Gospel of Mary, The Secret Revelation of John, and others. Now, some of these finds were made, you know, archaeological finds in the desert, but some of them we are still finding now in libraries. One of the most interesting was a recent discovery called the Gospel of the Savior, which was found in really literally in some tin cans that had been brought back from Egypt quite a while ago, and scholars were working through this material, and sure enough, here is this new gospel. The Gospel of Judas was discovered sometime in the early 1970s in Middle Egypt near Almania. It, too, is a 4th century Coptic codex written in Coptic. It's papyrus work called the Tsakas Codex. In it were three other works: the letter of Peter to Philip, the first apocalypse of James, and a book called Allogenes, which means something like the stranger or the foreigner. Now, the first two of these works, we also have copies of from the Nag Hammadi find. They're very interesting. Allogenes, we only have a few pages that have survived. Perhaps they're somewhere else. There's this, the history of the text itself, that is to say of the Tsakas Codex, has a regretful modern history, I guess we should say. When it was found in the early 70s, it was in excellent condition. Papyrologists who saw it there said it was nearly perfect. But what happened over the last 35 years since its discovery, it was the finders of it, the people who had it, really wanted to sell it for a great deal of money and weren't able to, and so they put it in storage. So it actually spent almost 17 years in a safety deposit box in New Jersey. Now, New Jersey's a fine place. Okay. But if you want to keep something preserved, you really want to keep it in Egypt, you know, and you want to keep it buried in that nice anaerobic sand and environment where things survive for centuries. So in the humidity, it was terribly damaged, and it began to fragment into smaller and smaller pieces. When someone finally went and looked at it, thinking now to sell it, they were amazed, in fact, astonished at how much deterioration had taken place. And so they did something even worse. They put it in a freezer. You know, preserve, freeze. No, okay? Okay, never do this with your ancient papyri, okay? Don't put them in the freezer, okay? But eventually it came into the hands of competent Coptologists, competent papyrologists, who spent 5 years restoring this text, really taking these small fragments and trying to put it back together into what we have. So if you now read the Gospel of Judas, which of course I hope you all will, you'll see that there are a lot of missing places, passages that are missing holes in the text. This is, of course, incredibly frustrating to those of us who could have read this text complete 35 years ago. So it's suffered much, much more since its discovery, as often happens with archaeological materials, than it did in the entire 1,500 years or more that it was buried. The real story about these texts, the Gospel of Judas and these other materials, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Thomas, a variety of other kinds of materials, is that they're letting us see that early Christianity, that Christianity in the first centuries, was much more diverse than we had ever expected. And what we're being able to do through reading these texts is to put us back into the experiences and the controversies and the issues that shaped Christianity as we've come to know it. It lets us see what they cared about, what they struggled with, and what divided them, what they fought over. Now, what does the Gospel of Judas itself tell us that's new? What do we learn from this text? Well, the most astonishing thing at first glance is that there's a Gospel of Judas, that there's a gospel attributed to the person who is Jesus' betrayer. It says Judas Iscariot. This isn't just, you know, I mean, Judas is a very common name, as we all know from the ossuary. No, we're not going there. Okay. Okay, but this is Judas Iscariot, and it's a clear reference to the Gospels and the literature of the person who betrayed Jesus, and yet this text portrays Judas as Jesus' most intimate disciple and confidant. The betrayer is the favored disciple, the only one, in fact, according to this gospel, who truly understood Jesus' teaching and the meaning of his death. Now, what are we to make of such a claim? What are we to make of such a gospel? The first thing that was said when this gospel was brought to light, when it was published by the National Geographic Society last year in April, was that it has the potential to overthrow Christian anti-Judaism. By rehabilitating the figure of Judas, the potential was there to undo the Christian claim that the Jews killed Christ. Because of this association of the name Judas with the name Jew, with the notion of killing Christ and the betrayal, this would have been all for the good. But it's not going to do that. And the reason is not because, well, Judas does turn out to be, if you will, the strong figure in this text. There is some rehabilitation of that figure, but the text itself, the Gospel of Judas, is very anti-Jewish. It still portrays the Jews as those who put Jesus to death, who lay in wait for him. It also portrays them as priests at the altar of the temple in Jerusalem, who were sacrificing human beings and killing people. It's really quite horrific, in fact, in its portrayal of Judaism in ways that are not only not historical, but that are really scurrilous. It mentions nothing about the Romans, who are the ones who did put Jesus to death. So is this going to help us in overthrowing Christian anti-Judaism? The answer to that, unfortunately, is no. Well, then is it going to tell us anything about the historical Judas? Or is it going to tell us anything about the historical Jesus? Or about the other disciples? And again, I think the answer to that question is no. This is a text that knows about the traditions of Judas from the first century, but it's a gospel that was written 100 years later. Scholars are agreed in dating it around 150, 160, in the middle of the second century, whereas Jesus himself lived in the early part of the first century. We think he died in the 30s sometime. This is reliant upon those kinds of materials. It's not telling us anything historical about what happened. Thirdly, the existence of the Gospel of Judas is actually not news, at least not to historians, because we know from a church father named Irenaeus, who was writing in Rome around 180, about the existence of such a gospel. And what he wrote about it was, he said this. He said, the Cainites, who he regarded as a group of heretics, okay, followers of Cain, okay, quote, declare that Judas the traitor was thoroughly acquainted with these things, and that he alone, knowing the truth as no others did, accomplished the mystery of the betrayal. By him, all things both earthly and heavenly were thus thrown into confusion, and they produced a fictitious history of this kind, which they style the Gospel of Judas, unquote. So we knew that there was such a text. We knew that there was a gospel ascribed to Judas. But that's all we knew. And quite frankly, this short notice in Irenaeus raised more questions for us than it answered. I mean, what was the truth that Judas knew? What is the mystery of the betrayal? Why did Judas throw heaven and earth into confusion? And now, quite frankly, that we have the Gospel of Judas and we would be able to answer these questions, the first impulse was, now that we have more questions than we had before. Because we want to ask this question, why would anyone be interested in portraying Judas as the disciple who really understood, if this is not the historical Judas? And why does Jesus laugh? Why does he mock the disciples' practice of the Eucharist, of the communal meal together? Why are the other 12 disciples condemned in this text as murderers who sacrifice their own wives and children and who fornicate on the altar of the temple? This is an astonishing portrait of the 12 disciples. Why is the author of this text so angry that he condemns fellow Christians to eternal oblivion forever? Is there any message of hope? What is the message of redemption that Jesus brings in this text? And how does this text understand the meaning of Jesus' death? So we have, and we're left with even more questions after reading the Gospel of Judas. And Elaine and I sat down shortly after the Gospel was released by National Geographic, and they posted not only the translation, but the Coptic text, you know, on the web. Isn't the web great? Okay. You know, and so we were working through this and working at the through some of the things that people had first said about this Gospel, and we thought, you know, they've missed it. They've missed what's really going on, because it isn't so shocking necessarily about Judas. What's really shocking is this portrait of the 12. What's going on in this text? What's really happening? So we decided to work on this text together and write a book, which is there it is, the result. And what we said, first of all, is that one has to read this text not in terms of the first century context that it says it's talking about. That is to say, it claims to be repeating and talking about the events around Jesus' death. Okay? But what it's really doing is it's telling the story of Jesus' death again. I mean, we have four accounts of this already in the New Testament canon. Four Gospels that tell about the teaching ministry of Jesus, about his death and about his resurrection and so forth. Christians were telling and retelling the story. And what we have now is we have another telling of that story. But it's one whose context lies in the second century, not the first century. And there, the context that fits this Gospel is the possibility of martyrdom and death that was present to Christians of that age. This was an issue of considerable concern both personally to people and especially theologically. Christians were hotly debating the meaning of Jesus' death and the suffering of martyrs. Now, if we look at what's going on in this period, and people Christians are asking these questions about what Jesus' death means, and they're talking about people who are dying for God. Okay? First of all, we see that many Christians were talking about Jesus' death as a sacrifice for sins. That they understood that he had died in order to redeem people from their sins. Secondly, they were talking about what kind of resurrection is there. And many people like Irenaeus, who I just quoted, were emphasizing very strongly the resurrection of the flesh. Not just the resurrection of a bodily resurrection, and not just the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, but the resurrection of all believers in the flesh. Thirdly, they were talking about martyrs' death as being in imitation of Christ, imitatio Christi. That their deaths too were sacrifices, and that they too would have a fleshly resurrection. So as their bodies were being killed, so they would be justified in being raised in the flesh. And finally, many Christians in this period were practicing Eucharist, were practicing the common meal that people had together as a sacrificial meal. That is to say, they were understanding the bread and the wine that they shared together in community as the body and blood of Jesus. The Gospel of Judas objects to all those things. It objects to understanding Jesus' death as a sacrifice. It objects to the notion that the resurrection will be a fleshly resurrection. Instead, it talks about the rise of the soul, the spirit-filled soul that will be with God. It rejects the notion that God desires the deaths of martyrs and sees them too as fleshly resurrections and as sacrifices. And it objects to understanding the communal meal as a sacrificial meal. So, what does it say? What is it talking about? What other kinds of views does it offer? Well, first we have to get into the story, into the narrative of the text itself. And it does this not by giving us a set of propositions, but by telling the story again. And in this case, we see that the 12 disciples and the portrait of Judas are used really in very similar ways to the ways in which they appear in the New Testament Gospels. If you read the Gospel of Mark, for example, you see that the disciples are often the ones who don't get it. You know, they, you know, sometimes I call this the idiot disciple motif, okay? You know, but what happens there is that when they don't get it, it provides an occasion for Jesus to correct them. So, for example, the disciples talk to Jesus about who will sit on his right and his left hand when he comes to rule. You know, and he tells them that it, not ruling, but serving others is what discipleship is about. Or Peter will say, oh, the rest are going to flee and, you know, leave you in the end, but not me. And then he goes ahead and betrays Jesus three times, you know. And so we learn from this portrayal of the disciples, even in the New Testament Gospels, that they're being shown to us in a way that allows us to illustrate what it means to be a disciple. And it allows us to illustrate and to correct. Jesus will use these, the narratives of the Gospels themselves, portray the disciples in ways that then lets Jesus correct and show what the true teaching is and to move people to a different place. Well, the Gospel of Judas is doing something quite similar. But the shocking thing here, of course, is the extreme way in which the 12 are used to illustrate what the teaching of Jesus in this gospel stands against. Okay? While the figure of Judas is the one to follow. He's the one who, if you follow him from the beginning of the text through to the end, he's the one who begins to understand more and more and more. So at the beginning, for example, he claims he knows who Jesus is. But at the same time, he has to avert his eyes. He can't look Jesus in the face. He can't look him straight in the eye. He averts his eyes. At other places in the and Jesus tells him to step aside, to separate himself from the others, and he's going to give him teaching. But then Judas at some points apparently doesn't understand the teaching, and Jesus tells him, your star is leading you astray. And he tries to correct that teaching and provide him more and more understanding of the mysteries of the kingdom. And in the end, finally, Judas understands. He's able now to lift his eyes up, you know, and to look and gaze into the heavenly sphere and indeed to ascend. So Judas is the one to watch, so to speak, to see what the progression of understanding is. As he corrects Judas's misunderstandings and leads him along the path, so too we come to understand more and more exactly what the teaching of Jesus about the mystery of the kingdom is. Now, the 12 disciples in this text, as I said, are portrayed in extraordinarily negative ways. We see this particularly when they come to Jesus with a dream. They have collectively had, I think it's more like a nightmare, okay? And they're extremely disturbed by it. And they come to Jesus to interpret it. What we see here is that this dream they've had draws what is really a wild caricature of priests at the altar leading multitudes astray by offering human sacrifice, something that was never done at the Jerusalem temple, okay? Committing all sorts of sins and immoralities, even killing their wives and children. And when the disciples, upset, come to Jesus and ask him, what does this mean? What does this dream mean that we've had? He tells them, you are those priests. You are the ones who are doing all this. You are the ones who are leading people astray. It's a shocking portrait. It's a shocking thing to tell them. Why? What is this about? Elaine and I thought long and hard about this and looked at the text and looked at what it's trying to do, and it seemed to us that the author is pointing toward what he saw as a stunning contradiction. While Christians, again, we're in the second century, remember, we're in the context of persecution, of Roman persecution of Christians. And Christians are being put to death by the Romans because they refuse to sacrifice, because they refuse to honor the gods of the Greeks and Romans, because Christians see that as idolatry, that it must be rejected, that the worship of false gods is precisely what leads one into immoral behavior and into sinfulness and so forth. One has to turn away from false gods to the worship of the true God. And Christians are doing that by refusing to sacrifice. Now, this is a day and age in which politics and religion are bound together. We could argue that's still true, but we're not going to go there, okay? But at least it was understood that way. And the Romans clearly understood that by refusing to worship the gods that supported the Roman Empire, this could be seen as an act of rebellion against Rome itself. And this is certainly one of the reasons why the Christians were being put to death. But the Gospel of Judas says, look what's happening. Christians are dying because they refuse to practice sacrifice. But here are Christian leaders bringing sacrifice right back into the center of Christian worship by claiming that Jesus' death is a sacrifice for human sin, and then by insisting that Christians who die as martyrs are sacrifices pleasing to God. We asked ourselves, Lane and I, had this author seen church leaders encouraging people, perhaps young men or women he knew, perhaps even members of his own family, to embrace death in this kind of way? Is that why he's so upset, he's so angry? We have no way of knowing. But what his writing does convey is a kind of urgency of someone who wants to unmask what he feels is a kind of hideous folly of religious leaders who are encouraging people to get themselves killed in this way, as though God wants their deaths, and as though this suffering is going to guarantee their own salvation. Now, the gospel itself, the Gospel of Judas, never actually attacks the believers who are dying. And indeed, in the end of the gospel, we see Judas hand Jesus over to his death. And we learn also in the gospel that the 12 disciples will stone Judas to death. So that in some sense, Judas becomes the first martyr. So this is not a text that is saying that martyrdom can be avoided. Okay, but what he really objects to is the leaders, the bishops of his own day, who are teaching that those who perfect themselves, this is the language that's used, that they perfect themselves for a martyr's death are ensuring that God will reward them by raising them physically from the dead. And the Gospel of Judas is saying these leaders are wrong both in the God that they worship and in thinking that the physical body will be raised to eternal life. They are in fact worshiping false gods. They are in fact slid back into the worship of idols. And they are slandering God and saying that God desires such sacrifice and such death. And now we're in a position to ask, why pick on the 12? We can understand this, again, by knowing that in the second century, we're beginning to get more and more reliance of authority on the notion of apostolic succession. That is to say, the notion that Jesus appointed 12 of his followers and they then appointed bishops after them. So that the leaders in the second century who are claiming that their authority is based on a line of succession going back to the 12. Okay? So you can see that if one wants to criticize the bishops in one's own day, criticizing the 12 is a good way to do it, because that undermines the kind of authority that they would have insofar as they're resting their authority on the 12. But why are these errors arising in the second century? Why does the Gospel of Judas say that people are led astray? And here is where the teaching of Jesus come in. Jesus teaches that errors like this, that people are being led astray into thinking wrongly about God and into worshiping idols, because people are unable to perceive that anything exists beyond this material, visible world. They're unable to understand their place in the larger, divine universe. And so because of this, the true God and Father of Jesus, who comes from the heavenly realm beyond this world, sent Jesus to teach and to heal. And Jesus in this text teaches Judas that there is a wider universe of the spirit beyond the limited world that people here perceive. And unless people come to know it, they will never truly know God, and they will never truly fulfill their own spiritual nature, because there is another glorious divine realm above the material world. And there's an immortal holy race that dwells there, worshiping in the heavenly temple, beyond and above the perishable mortal race below. And it's this teaching that is the mystery of the kingdom. Now, as long as people remain ignorant of this, they fall easy prey to these false gods. But Jesus appeared on earth in order to show the true nature of the universe and the end time, so that everyone who understood these things could turn away from the worship of false gods with all of its sacrificial violence and immorality and discover their own true spiritual nature. So in this way, the Gospel of Judas shows us that the violence of Roman killings, whether of Jesus or of his disciples or Christians in the second century, that this violence of the Romans was taking an enormous toll on Christian communities that we as historians had really not fully appreciated. It was dividing communities. It was splitting communities apart. But once we see this, once we start asking that question, we can see evidence all over the place of how much controversy there was about this issue. And we can see evidence of how that controversy was silenced in later Christian history, where the story that has come down to us heroizes the martyrs, sees them as the great founders and heroes of the faith. As Tertullian famously said, that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. But in this period in the second century when this was going on, we can see from the Gospel of Judas that the divisions that were caused weren't only a deeply emotional response, but they raised, and perhaps primarily raised, very serious theological issues. People were saying, didn't Jesus suffer so that we would not have to suffer and die? What kind of God is this who would demand the death of his child and worshipers to satisfy his need for glory and honor? How could Christians die for refusing to sacrifice and yet claim that Jesus' own death was a sacrifice? As the age of martyrdom closed with the conversion of the Roman Emperor Constantine in the 4th century, stories glorifying the martyrs came to dominate the whole history of Christian origins, providing spiritual heroes for the new imperial church. But the Gospel of Judas restores to us one voice of dissent, a call for religion to renounce violence in God's name, to renounce violence as satisfying God's will and purpose for humanity. I think that examining ancient Christian claims about violence that serves God's purpose, or claims that violence itself serves God's purpose, brings historians into an arena fraught with complexities and ambiguities, contested stories, theological controversies, loud voices, and in some ways even louder, deafening silences. But by dismissing the Gospel of Judas too quickly because it's regarded as heresy, and it still is regarded as heresy, I think we lose many possible ways in which the Gospel of Judas might challenge us. We lose much that might be useful to think and speak about in our own uncertain age, when great uncertainties are headlined every day in our news, when issues about religion and violence are not things that belong to the past. So what is the mystery of the kingdom that Jesus is teaching? Well, he teaches that God is the creator of everything that exists, the heavenly world and the world below. And he follows the story of Genesis in saying that God looked down on this realm of chaos and oblivion and disorder, and brought goodness to it by bringing it order and light, and by setting powers to rule over it. The book of Genesis says that God created the sun and moon and the stars and set them in the heavens in order to rule over the world. And by the time that this text was written, these were often understood as angelic powers, as angels who God had set to rule over the world. And this is part of God's goodness, okay, in bringing order to the world. But the Gospel of Judas says, Jesus teaches in this text, that in ruling over this world of chaos and oblivion, the rulers had to, in some sense, take part in it, become something like it. And so these rulers that God set over the world were subject to error. And insofar as they were subject to error, they led people astray. And they are the ones, then, who demands bloody sacrifice. They are the ones who are leading people astray into thinking that Jesus' death and the suffering of martyrs is something desired by the true God. They're saying we are the true God, and in fact hiding people from understanding who God really is. Jesus teaches that at the end of time, and even at death, human beings will be divided into two groups. Those who will perish utterly, and those who will ascend forever to the heavenly temple, to the heavenly world, to be with God. Now, he talks about this by saying that everyone is created in the image of God. Everyone is created in the image of the heavenly Adam. This, again, is following both the interpretation of Genesis, and it's following this this idea, again, that the image of God is... Adam is the image of God, and so insofar as we're created in the image of God and Adam is that image, then we're created in the image of Adam. Okay, that made sense. Sorry. Okay. Anyway, whatever. Okay. So everybody is made in the image of God, in the image of the heavenly Adam. One of the few things I actually love about this text, which is problematic in so many ways, is it also says that we are all made in the image of God, but that we all seek life in the name of Eve. Because Eve is understood as the mother of the living. And her name, both in Hebrew and in Greek, means life. Okay? And so you are to seek life. People are to seek life in the name of Eve. Everyone has the potential, okay, to ascend to God. Because God has given spirits to everyone. So people have mortal bodies of flesh and blood, people have souls, and everyone also has a spirit that comes from God. But what happens is that those people who worship false gods and idols and engage in violence, like the 12 apostles who stoned Judas to death and sacrificed people and so forth, they bind their souls to the material nature of the world and to those gods, and so they perish with it. They perish with those gods and with this world. But those who follow the teachings of Jesus, as Judas learns to do by the end of this text, bind their souls instead to the Spirit of God and to the living truth. And so at the end of the age and at their death, they then ascend to the higher sphere to live with God. So the question is, where does one turn? What God does one worship? The material gods of this world who demand violence, or does one turn to the true God above, who is the God of light, the God of Jesus? So what is the good news, if there is any, in this gospel? It teaches that people have, in their inmost nature, their most true self is a spiritual connection with God. Those who hear the message of Jesus in this text are called upon to recognize that rather than being simply physical bodies with complex psychological components, souls, you know, we are fundamentally spiritual beings who need to discover what in us belongs to the Spirit. This gospel suggests that our lives consist of more than what biology or psychology can explore, that our real life begins when the Spirit of God transforms the soul. So what have we missed in only having stories, texts like Irenaeus that decry, that go against this kind of gospel, that call it heresy, and so on and so forth. I think what we've missed potentially is the serious critique, not so much of martyrdom, but of the glorification of martyrdom and violence, and of what it makes into God, the suggestion that this is what comes from God. So in the end, we thought the Gospel of Judas, far from being bizarre and marginal, as those of you might have read it might think too when you first read it, okay, but far from being bizarre and marginal as we initially suspected, it leads us right into the center of the debates about what Christianity would become. Thank you.
Thank you to Karen. I see a lot of new faces here tonight, so I just want to go over the ground rules to make it simple for everyone. We have folks in the aisles with mics. If you raise your hands, we will try to get to as many of you as we can in the allotted time. And please keep your hand up so we can see you and get the mic to you. Who would like to start us off? Right here, gentleman in the yellow.
I should say that not only questions, but criticisms and comments are also very welcome.
Hi, I had a question for you. Kind of bonusing off of what you said and some of the things you may have alluded to. I mean, we know from just extant writings that the first and second generation Christians after the apostles knew the New Testament really well, quoted from it, were immersed in its theology and that sort of thing. And I mean, they didn't even feel the need to say Mark and Luke were written by apostles. They were willing to say it was written by people who weren't apostles. I mean, so given all that we know in that regards, why would, not the Discovery Channel, but why was National Geographic, your claims were kind of muted compared to the advertisements for the Gospel of Judas. That not that this overthrew what the apostles told us, but this is kind of what somebody in the second century is telling us with no connection to the apostles. Then I'm kind of wondering, not, I don't want you to have to bite the hand that feeds you, if possible, or maybe that would apply more to Miss Pagels, but why the kind of the sensational advertising saying this overthrew everything we knew?
Well, let me take, there are several pieces of that I want to talk to. One is about, you know, advertising and commercialism to begin with, and what that's about. And you know, of course, the publishers are interested in making wild claims. But I think what we didn't say that it would overturn everything that one would knew, but that, in fact, this is telling us some things that we didn't know. That there were controversies about these issues. And one of them is precisely, I think, the point you're making about the New Testament Gospels. The first Christians didn't have a New Testament. The Christians of the first, second, and third centuries are the people who wrote the books that came to be in the New Testament. The collection of the New Testament itself, that is to say, as a collection of literature, took shape over a period of several centuries. We only first find in the late 4th century a list of canonical books that came to be in our New Testament the way it is. And it isn't actually until you get to the Council of Trent that the Catholic Church actually makes a ruling on a canon of literature as such. Now, by then, certainly the New Testament books had been scripture for a long time, certainly since the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries. But these are the people who are writing it. What the Gospel of Judas and these other texts are doing is they put us back into a period in which Christianity as we know it was coming into being. They put us back into a period in which these Christians didn't have a New Testament. They didn't have a set leadership of church order. They didn't have a creed on which everyone agreed. They were struggling with these kinds of issues. And as a historian, then, we can talk about what does the Gospel of Judas tell us that we didn't know? And I think one of the things that it tells us is that some Christians were able to talk about and understand Judas as the disciple who truly understood. And in that, where is the challenge in that? Well, for contemporary Christians, I think most people, vast majority, let's say 99.99% are not going to want to add the Gospel of Judas to the New Testament. And I'm going to vote with them, okay? I don't actually like this gospel very much. It's violent, it's homophobic, it's anti-Jewish. We don't need that kind of thing. But as an historian, what this gospel does is it paints for us a much richer portrait of what early Christianity was like. It lets us see the controversies out of which Christianity, as we know it, was shaped and how it came to be.
Next question. Gentleman in the blue here.
Hello. I read your book, What is Gnosticism? And the Gospel of Mary Magdala, and quite a few of Elaine's books. And I'm curious, because all the issues about Gnosticism, I'm curious if you see any Gnostic aspects in this Gospel of Judas. And if you do, I'd appreciate your commenting on that.
Sure. I mean, one of the first things, again, that was said about this gospel was that it was a Gnostic gospel. It belongs to Gnosticism. Of course, that immediately raises the question, what is Gnosticism? The term itself, Gnosticism, it came into being in the 17th century in the context of Protestant anti-Catholicism. It's a way for modern scholars to categorize some of the varieties of early Christianity. What these texts were called in the early church was heresy. Okay? They were, you know, talking about different kinds of heresies. So I have this little thing that I call the Three Bears version of varieties of early Christianity. Okay? Because scholars have divided them into three types. You've got Jewish Christianity, Gnosticism, and Orthodoxy. And Jewish Christianity is too much Judaism, and it's too positive. And Gnosticism is too little Judaism, and it's too negative. And Orthodoxy is just right. Yes, I know you got it. Okay. Now, that's a modern kind of categorization. And what it does is it tells us that for modern scholars, and this is partially true to a large degree for ancient scholars as well, one of the central problems of Christian development was setting the boundaries with Judaism. Because Christianity claims, on the one hand, the Jewish heritage, and on the other hand, comes to separate from it. You know, and so this is a text, you know, so Gnosticism is supposed to be texts which have gone too far, separated too hard, if you will. But there are also ways in which scholars have gone through the early literature on the heresies and then have made lists of things. Now, this text fits some of those things. For example, it fits the teaching that argues against the resurrection of the body. Now, Christian orthodoxy in the 4th century and beyond is going to argue, for example, in the resurrection of the flesh, not just for Jesus, but for all believers. This is not a position that this text takes. Okay. On the other hand, many other of these early Christian gospels that have been labeled Gnostic argued that the true God did not create this world. This text argues that God did create this world and did put the angels in charge. And it's much closer in many ways to the book of Revelation, which sees that we're in a period now where God is ultimately in charge, ultimately in control, but that there are Satan and his minions are ruling this world, and that there will be a judgment at the end when those who are true will live with God and those who are not will perish. In the book of Revelation, they're eternally punished. In this text, they perish utterly. Okay. But what I would argue, and the reason that I never use this terminology of Gnostic and Gnosticism and so on and so forth, is I want us to get back into the imagination of a period before we knew who would be the winners. So sometimes when people ask me to say, who are the Gnostics, I say, they're the losers. You know, they're the ones who we now call heretics because they lost out in the debate. And it's very clear that if you take all of the literature that has been categorized as Gnostic, they represent a very wide range of points of view, a wide range and diverse opinions. And I think it behooves us, especially as scholars and historians, but of people in general, to take a very careful look at those texts and see what they're doing and what they're doing differently, not only from the material that has come down to many Christian churches today as authoritative, but also with regard to the historical kinds of positions they have. And then communities of faith today have to ask again, do these texts have any value for us? And many communities are already saying no. Others are saying, well, I need to look at that. I want to take a closer look at that. Some people are finding much in these texts that enriches their Christian spirituality in their life. And other people are saying no. So we're going to have as much diversity in the reception of these texts, I think, today, perhaps as one saw in the second century.
Next question. Gentleman in the blue right here.
I would say, as a couple comments, I think the early disciples, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, had a fear-based projection in the things that they said about what happened. In that, you know, they held Christ in awe when all he was just like everybody else, only more enlightened. The idea of sacrifice is a fear-based thought system based on scarcity and lack, which all ultimately goes back to the belief in the separation from God in the Adam and Eve story. So it's like we live in an ego world, and scarcity and sacrifice and martyrdom are no more than a mental construct that a scarcity ego thought system makes up. None of it is real. The world is nothing but abundant, and it's only the separation from God and the creation of that ego thought system that makes us think that there is lack and there is scarcity. And I would say that Judas, the Gospel of Judas, was the closest of all the Gospels to authenticating the experience with Christ, in that he was really showing that we are not our bodies. We are much more than our bodies. We are spiritual beings that just happen to seem like we're in a body, but we're really not. And the belief back then, of course, believing that people were a body, there was much, much fear in the world, and therefore the Christian early Gospels created this projection. You know, there's no Christ that would ever believe that someone could betray him. Betrayal was not a thought that Christ could hold. A Christ could not believe in anger or vengeance, as often
the
early Gospels
show. Sir, why don't we let Dr. King comment on your comment?
It's actually interesting that the whole issue of sacrifice is an extraordinarily complex one, and sacrificial systems and religions and what they mean, I think, do very different kinds of things and very different kinds of work. And I'm not going to spend much time talking about sacrificial systems as such, and particularly psychologically. But I think it's interesting to point out that some of these texts, and I'm thinking particularly here of a work called The Apocryphon of James, The Letter of Peter to Philip. These are two texts that argue that Jesus is indeed like us. You know, and Jesus came to show us precisely what we are, that we are spiritual people. In one of these texts, Jesus tells his disciples, if you hurry, you'll even get to heaven before me. And he argues that you have to be able to bring people along, to convince them, to teach them the truth before you get to ascend. You have this text in which James and Peter have started to ascend, and the disciples call them back, and they're really angry. We were on our way, you know. And they learned that, no, you don't get to go until you brought others. And so Jesus doesn't get to ascend to God until he's brought others along with him. So it's very much this kind of equalizing, sort of shocking thing. The church did not go that way. You might know that, okay? Yes. But I think it's very interesting to know that precisely that there is that this is part of some of the range of views that Jesus is showing us who we are spiritually. And the text took some very radical, these Christians were very radical people and took some very radical positions on this material.
Gentleman in the white right here.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. Just for disclaimer, I am one of these Christians, just so you know that. One of the things I was kind of curious about is you separate the Old Testament from this discussion, and I think it's quite relevant to this.
I think you need to hold it closer.
I'm sorry. Yeah. You separated the Old Testament from this discussion, and it's quite relevant because Christianity consists of the Old Testament and the New Testament. And I was just curious about why you did that. That's one question I have for you. The second one is that it was quite clear that Christ gave the example of martyrdom on the cross when a dying thief that was saved next to him, he did not take off the cross. He allowed to be killed along with him. And so I think that's a very good example how martyrdom that was established within the church as being acceptable because he was not taken off the cross. And the second and the third question I have, no, it's all along the same line of thought, okay? Mm-hmm. Is that in the Old Testament, the prophets were killed. They were stoned. There was a long history of this occurring so that you would expect that would be happening when Christ the Son came, that he would actually be put to the cross. And as you know, Cain and Abel, Cain slew Abel because of his testimony to Cain. That was the first example of death. So that's where I'm going with this question. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the Old Testament in terms of this, because it's very relevant.
It's interesting that you said the Old Testament was left out. I mean, you're right. The scriptures that the first Christians had were the Hebrew scriptures, mostly translated into Greek. And that were those, when Christians talked about the scriptures in the first century in the Gospels, they say, as it is written, they're referring to the Hebrew scriptures, not, interestingly enough, the New Testament. Of course, I was talking about the Gospel of Judas as retelling the Gospel story, and the Gospels are New Testament. That's a New Testament genre. It's about the meaning of Jesus' death and so on and so forth. But even in this Gospel of Judas, of course, we were talking about Genesis and cosmology. There's a lot of material in this text about the Psalms, and I think even some intertestamental literature like Enoch and so on and so forth. But you're right. The question is, as I was trying to raise before, how were Christians defining their relationship to Judaism? You know, and to the Jewish scriptures. And this is a text which clearly sees the teachings of Jesus in continuity with Jewish scriptures because he's telling the story of Genesis again, you know, and talking about them. Now, I've sort of forgotten your second question. But the third one was the one that really interested me. Because if we talk about the ways in which the prophets also were put to death, oh, I remember it was the guy on the cross. Okay, the thieves that were killed with Jesus were never understood by the early church as martyrs. The first martyr is always understood to be Stephen in the book of Acts. Okay, why? You know, why is that the case? Jesus' death as a martyrdom is also something that modern scholars have looked at very closely in terms of seeing him as a Jewish martyr and how that's part of his portrayal. But again, what interested me most was precisely your saying that we see the Hebrew prophets also being stoned and put to death. And I want to use that as a way to talk about the fact that there were multiple sources and multiple resources, including the Hebrew scriptures and intertestamental Jewish literature and other kinds of literature, for understanding the meaning of Jesus' death. And one of the things I was taught as a Methodist, you know, is this notion that the meaning of Jesus' death is that he died for our sins, and that that's attached to notions about original sin and overcoming it and so on and so forth. When one reads the New Testament literature, and I am talking about the New Testament as the Christian book, they do draw on lines of Hebrew and Jewish theology. There's a variety of ways in which Jesus' death is understood, in addition to being a sacrifice for sin. One can see this in some ways in the ways that anybody might react to a senseless and unjust violence that leads to the death of someone that one cares for and loves. And one might react with anger and with the desire for revenge. And we see this enacted in these texts. In particular, I think the book of Revelation tends to blame the Romans, you know, and to talk about, you know, the whore sitting on the seven hills and drinking the blood of the Lamb and so forth, and this kind of thirst for justice in the face of injustice. Or one can see, I think, the Gospel of Luke, which tends to blame the Jews, you know. So the question, find somebody to blame and punish, okay? Tied, if one will, to search for justice in the face of injustice, to ask where is God's justice in this act. The Gospel of Mark is extraordinarily powerful, I think, in that it argues that God's power, God's kingdom, God's rule is found in powerlessness, in giving up worldly power and everything that is in this world and assenting to God's will, and that's what Jesus on the cross means. Is that the only power is God's power, not the power of the world. It's a kind of powerlessness that we call for. James Cone talks about this, for example. He says that in America, we have to, in order to have an American Christ and to really appreciate an American Christ on the cross, we have to look at a black man hanging on the lynching tree. That we have to understand and make meaning of those things in terms of each other. Or this notion that Jesus died for us. I think the Gospel of John sees this as a sign of God's love for humanity, as the moment in which the Spirit of God was sent to form a new community and the new possibility of community. This was another way in which Jesus' death was understood. Or Paul. Paul sees Jesus' death as this moment where the promises made to Israel are now going to be made available to everyone. That it's a spreading out of the capacity to be Abraham's children through faith, and that's accomplished by Jesus on the cross. Or that Jesus died as a political revolutionary, that Christians are called to act in solidarity with the poor and the oppressed, that's the meaning of Jesus on the cross. Or that Jesus' death set people free from death itself and arranged for the possibility of immortality. In other words, one finds a very rich vocabulary, theological vocabulary that people were struggling with in talking about the meaning of Jesus' death, not just this one kind of point of view. And the Gospel of Judas and other texts, theologians in the second, third, and up to the modern period today, then are still struggling with this kind of issue of how to understand the meaning of suffering and death in the face of God's love and compassion and so forth.
Folks, we have time for one more question. There was a lady in blue on the aisle here.
Very short, and that's the point, maybe. But you mentioned Revelations. When was that written? When did that come into being?
Well, scholars think, depending on who you ask, that perhaps some of the Book of Revelations is as early as the 60s, but the final date is probably sometime in the 90s of the first century. Often scholars try again to place it with regards to persecutions against Christians. But other scholars have argued that the real problematic that the Book of Revelation is dealing with is precisely that Jesus' resurrection has overcome Satan, has overcome the power of evil and so forth, and yet the Romans are still in charge. They're putting people to death. And so it's dealing with that crisis, if you will, of regard to this dissonance between the faith that they hold and what they're seeing going on in the world. But people usually place it in the last decades, the first century.
Revelation is a perfect place to end this evening. Yeah. Please thank Dr. King. And please join us upstairs for the book signing. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.